welcome back to Doing It, the Sex and Relationships podcast where sex has never been so nerdy, with me, your host, Hannah Witten. This week, I'm joined by Dr. Emma Chan. Emma is a doctor working in mental health and is the reproductive and sexual health lead at the School of Sexuality Education. She's also one of the co-creators of the book Sex Ed, an Inclusive Teenage Guide to Sex and Relationships, and a green activist. Before moving into mental health, Emma worked as a doctor in OBS and gynae, and so between her experience working with pregnant people and helping reform sex education, I wanted to get Emma onto the podcast to talk all about what current sex education misses out regarding pregnancy and how mental health needs to be a part of sex ed. Our talk was so fascinating and far-reaching, from how sex education needs to cover important topics including fertility, miscarriage, and the actual experience of being pregnant, not just how to avoid it. We discussed reproductive rights and how to navigate the climate crisis whilst wanting to have a baby. We spoke about mental health, emotional vocabulary, and the importance of teaching communication skills to help young people express themselves. And we also explored how to make pregnancy health care spaces more inclusive to trans people and working towards greater contraceptive equality. I loved this chat because Emma shared a lot about how to talk about pregnancy, both in sex education and in healthcare, in a way that is more inclusive to the diverse experiences people can have. And please note, in this episode, we do talk about miscarriage, so please take care of yourself before listening. As usual, you can find more info and links to everything we talked about in this episode in the show notes over at doingitpodcast.co.uk. And please let us know what you think over on our Twitter or Instagram, which is at doingitpodcast. If you like this episode, please give us a rating and review over on iTunes and Spotify. It's really appreciated. And without further ado, here is my chat with Dr. Emma Chan. Hi, Emma. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm really excited to chat with you.
Oh, no problem. It's great to be here.
Good stuff. So for those who don't know you, you are a medical doctor and you also work with like the School of Sex Ed and an RSE facilitator. And I remember when I first reached out to you about getting you on the podcast, I was really keen to talk about like OBS and gynae stuff, as that's like one of your specialties. And then now that I'm like a bit further along in pregnancy and stuff, I realized that I don't actually have any questions about that that are more general, because I'm like, oh no, I want to save my stuff for my actual doctors who like know my individual case. And I was curious about like how education around things like fertility and pregnancy work when it's often such an individual thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good question. And I think there's sort of two slightly different things in there. There's a kind of like pregnancy as like a thing in society, people getting pregnant, sort of understanding what everyone in society goes through, or people in society go through, even if it's not like a something that will kind of individually apply to you or apply to you now. Mm-hmm. And then there's kind of like pregnancy and fertility and infertility as like really personal experiences that some people may never go through, that some people may never have. But I think there are those kind of two things, and I think they kind of, I don't think education does recognize that those are two sort of separate things. And I think within the education system, often we sort of just reduce pregnancy to young people certainly as like, don't do it. Like
yeah.
this is like a process that you'll learn about later when you're older. Don't know how much older, but sometime in the future. Like definitely after you left school, and you don't really need to worry about it until then. So we're going to talk about condoms now.
Yeah.
And I feel like that tends to be the sort of like dominant model within schools for loads of different reasons. So I think your original question was how does kind of learning about pregnancy and fertility and infertility work in education? And I guess it's kind of, I feel like it doesn't always work as kind of relating it to experiences that are kind of might be personal and individual. And yeah, it's a very, yeah, kind of detached. It sort of taught us something that's very detached and not for you.
Yeah.
Child ever.
Do you find then, because obviously you're kind of in a position where you've seen the young person side of things in education, but then also like as a doctor, you see like the adult side of things when it's like somebody's like lived experience, like what happens to these young people who then become adults who might get pregnant? And then, yeah, what do you get people coming in like,
I think that's
what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a, how do you get from like this like teenager who's told don't get pregnant to being or don't get someone pregnant, mm-hmm. Regardless of what kind of sexuality or sex you're having, don't get pregnant. That's all we worry about. To like an adult who maybe tries to get pregnant or tries to or has to deal with like infertility problems or how does that happen?
Yeah.
And I think it's just really basically, I feel like often we don't get that. There's no opportunity to get that from sort of like formal education. Mm-hmm. So people get that from other sources. I hope including like the Doing It podcast, some of those like sources are really good and really kind of nuanced and really nice. And some of them are not really. Mm. So
I did read this article. Yeah. It was a lot more like US focused, but it was talking a lot about like the amount of misinformation out there online that is targeted at pregnant people, often like trying to sell them stuff. It might be more of a US problem, but obviously it's still like an internet thing, which everyone has access to. Not everyone, but a lot of people.
I think that's a really interesting thing. So I work for the School of Sexuality Education, and I kind of came at that from being like particularly working in obs and gynae and people just knowing very little about their bodies until kind of they were actually like pregnant, and no one had really spoken to them until that point about like what pregnancy was like as an experience. And that's kind of how I got into it. But I don't think that is a US thing. That's sort of one of the few sources that you'll come at kind of pregnancy and fertility at is from like people trying to sell you stuff and essentially being like a customer rather than a student or a friend or a whatever other roles. So one of the things that I see, like I've noticed quite a lot, is not necessarily like inaccurate material, but like sort of biased, like stuff that's quite biased around kind of pregnancy and fertility. So I, with a friend, developed a like period tracking app because a lot of what I saw, a lot of the kind of commercial apps kind of do is like they're trying to sell you something like as a product, and some of the advice they're kind of giving you kind of supports that being a product rather than that being necessarily educational. So
About health when you're, which
absolutely. So if you're not like a patient or a friend or and you're a customer, that's your role. Like there's a very specific kind of bias that you get, I think, and it's not always what you need or want. Does that sort of answer your question?
It's so interesting to me as well, because I guess that like pregnant people are like, for lack of a better word, like a lucrative market, because we're like big spenders, but also like we're really vulnerable like physically
absolutely.
And emotionally during that time, where like there's a lot of things to potentially be anxious about. And so there's a lot of, and then also with the lack of education of just like not having that foundational knowledge of like what the experience is about to be for you. I think it can be really tricky to navigate with a lot of like bad actors trying to manipulate you a lot of the time.
Yeah, definitely. Or not even like bad, I think definitely are bad actors, but like not even bad, but just sort of like they're kind of agenda is different from yours.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like a lot of stuff. So one of the big things when I was, so I'm quite passionate about the need to sort of talk to young people about pregnancy in like a non-judgmental way. Mm-hmm. So not in a framing it like a, you must never get pregnant, which I think unintentionally or otherwise, yeah, is the kind of message.
Because also, you never know, there might be a pregnant young person in that room as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's not like, it's not unheard of. And also, like, even if those people in the room, like, pregnancy isn't a thing for them now, personally, like, they might have like older siblings or parents, mm-hmm, or people around them that are kind of pregnant, and just sort of kind of shrouding it in this kind of like mystery and like it's not for you, like, makes it even more taboo and even more. So one of the things that I found a lot when I was in like clinical practice in that area, I work in mental health now, so I don't work so much with sort of pregnant people, but when I was working in kind of gynecology, like quite a lot of the sort of work is around sort of seeing people who are having like problems in early pregnancy, so specifically kind of early pregnancy bleeding, and potentially that's a sign of miscarriage. And miscarriage is incredibly, incredibly common. Mm-hmm. I think it's something like overall, something like 1 in 5 recognized pregnancies end in miscarriage. So it's a very common experience. And I've basically, everyone I've ever met who's had this really incredibly common experience thought that it was really rare, that it was something that they had done, because that's not the sort of narrative of normal pregnancy that they've heard. So they think this is a really unusual experience, and it must be something they've done. They've done something wrong, because, like, why else would this be happening? Yeah. And a lot of, like, I spent a lot of time talking to people about how this was a really common thing. And I think that is completely like an education thing, because we tend not to talk about anything beyond how not to get pregnant.
Yeah, it's not like, not even acknowledging the, like, maybe wanting to get pregnant and that not also, like, potentially going to plan as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So you mentioned that you now work in mental health. So I wanted to talk about that a bit as well. And I'm curious about how that intersects with the relationships and sex education work that you do. Because, I mean, from my experience, like, I don't even remember mental health even being touched on in general, let alone in how it relates to how we relate to each other and ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. I think something that I've just become very conscious of is how, when we sort of talk about relationships and sexuality, is how sort of limited in, like, general conversation, like, our sort of, like, emotional vocabulary is. So we do workshops with young people about, like, relationships and, like, what a kind of healthy relationship looks like, and even, like, what kind of healthy conflict looks like. But we don't, I find, like, often, not always, and you do get some really, like, really kind of switched on young people who are obviously having conversations with lots of people around them, and their kind of families. But often, like, you literally kind of ask, like, how, so we do a lot of, like, watching video clips of, and sort of trying to kind of analyze stuff and trying to bring in, like, a broader, like other areas of the curriculum, for example. So kind of like looking at, like, media and art and literature and whatever. And we just ask quite simple questions, like, so how do you think this person is feeling?
Yeah.
And, like, sometimes you'll get some really lovely nuanced response, and sometimes, like, it's just, people are just like, I don't know, like, what what is that? Or another one that sometimes stumps students, we ask them, like, what qualities do you have that you kind of bring to a good relationship? Like, what do you value in yourself?
Ooh, and again, they're just like, oh my god, yeah.
And that's often our sort of opening gambit in terms of, like, yeah, kind of, hi I'm Emma, I work for School of Sexuality Education, here are the ground rules, what do you value about yourself?
Wow.
And people are really, really stumped, and I don't think that is that they don't have answers, it's just they've never been asked to, like, articulate those,
the things they like about themselves
or think about it. Yeah. Like, it's often they'll be like, even with quite chatty classes in general, they'll just be silenced for a little bit, and it's like, well, what do you, yeah.
That's so interesting
as a person,
because I assume that if you asked, like, the reverse question of, like, things that they don't like about themselves maybe or don't value. Like people would easily be able to list off like so much stuff. But I think that's such a powerful question for everyone to kind of like take a moment and be like, hey, what makes me a good partner? Like, what do I value in myself that I think would make me good in a relationship?
Yeah, it was when you said the reverse question, it was interesting. I thought you were going to say like what they look for in other people, which we do actually ask them. And they are much more often much more like fluent about like what they value about other people. And I think there is something about this, like maybe it's a bit of a like modest British thing.
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
Like about your, but I think that's really sad that like you can't, like I think it's still like possible to be like a modest, empathetic, self-reflective person and still like recognize that, yeah, these are things that I like about myself.
Yeah. I think that if that's something that maybe you're struggling to come up with, like I just thought that a good like thing to do to kind of like help you start that list is to ask like a good friend or like some a family member who's close to you to be like, hey, what do you value in me? You know, and then get them to just like shower you with compliments. Then you can be like, oh yeah, I am a bit like that, aren't I? Like, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. That's actually kind of like a therapy technique. And we do sometimes do it if they're really struggling. Like what would a good friend say about you?
Yeah.
Because then you're not being, it kind of gives you a bit of detachment and you're not saying like what,
I think that I am amazing. Yeah. You're going like, what will my friends say this about me?
Like I've heard that as a tip for dating profiles as well. Like if you're struggling because you're quite a kind of quite a modest person, like what would a good friend notice about you? What do you think they would say about you? So
I just wanted to pull up something that you mentioned earlier about how you do workshops on what healthy conflict looks like.
Yeah.
And I'd love to dive into that a bit more about like, what is healthy conflict and like how do you navigate that and how can you discern the difference between a healthy conflict and a not healthy one? Because I think like a lot of people say things like, oh, well, me and my partner never argue, so it's a perfect relationship, or like, oh, we bicker all of the time, and so, or like those people, they bicker all of the time, so their relationship must be terrible. Do you know, we have these kind of like quite black and white assumptions about what conflict is and what it looks like and if it's a good or a bad thing. And I want to ask about that.
Yeah, I think that's been a really interesting one for me personally to deliver, because I think I'd never really thought about that before. Mm-hmm. With some of the other stuff, maybe it's like stuff that I've been kind of taught through my job, or like I had a good kind of sense of, but I realized that I didn't actually, like some of it was like not new concepts like necessarily, but things that I hadn't really thought about in myself. And I think that's quite an important thing as well, like with all areas of kind of sex ed, is like thinking about like being self-reflective and actually what am I like, not just assuming that you know the answers. Mm-hmm. Which I think like the current sort of setup for school sex ed often does that. They're like, well, you're an adult, so you must have everything together.
Yeah.
So it's been quite an interesting, So I think I kind of accept, like accept implicitly, accept the idea that actually a good relationship isn't that you always absolutely perfectly agree with each other and you never argue about anything. I kind of recognize that. And students usually recognize that as well. They'll be, so I sort of ask like, does a good relationship mean you never disagree about anything? And they're like, no, there definitely is like a room for like disagreement. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But yeah, personally, I've never really like sat down and before I'd done the workshop, I'd never sat down and asked the students to, I'd never done what we asked the students to do in terms of like, well, what actually does that look like? And what are you trying to do with a kind of a conflict that you want to get resolved, or is like a healthy way of kind of trying to come to some agreement or not? And what does like an argument that's like abusive or harmful, what does that look like? And what's the difference between those two things? That wasn't something that I'd really personally like thought about.
So what are some of the kind of like tips, I guess, if it can be done succinctly at all, of resolving conflict?
Yeah, so I guess it's about like what you're trying to do. So you're on the same team. You're not necessarily just denying your experiences, like not actually it's fine and I'm wrong, but like what is, like trying to listen to the other person and where are they coming from. And yeah, I think the most sort of succinct way I've ever heard it described is like coming at things as if you're on the same, well, you are on the same team, mm-hmm. rather than trying to like point score and win the argument. Yeah. And I think that's quite interesting to do in a school environment, because often we do really privilege this idea of being like good at debate and like clever and winning the argument. And the worst thing that can happen is that you have to say that you were wrong, where actually we kind of encourage, like if you've said something wrong or you think actually talking through things you've made a mistake, then it's like it's fine to apologize, like that's the correct mm-hmm, thing to do, mm-hmm. which I think we also really don't, as a cultural thing, we don't really accept. It's about being the cleverest, it's about having the best argument, and I think we sometimes take those skills from other areas of our life and kind of bring them into our sort of personal relationships where they don't, I think, belong as comfortably.
I definitely felt that, like at the beginning of my current relationship. Oh my God, this is just like bringing back so many memories, because my partner loves a debate and like loves kind of like exploring a lot of like philosophical ideas and stuff. And if he like presented an idea to me and I disagreed with it, and then he, you know, carried on exploring it and stuff, but he's very like, I don't know, direct, shall we say. And I would start getting really upset because I felt like he was attacking me. And we would get into these like really heated debates, like luckily not about us and our relationship. It was always about these kind of like hypotheticals and stuff. And then I just remember this being a pattern and like sitting down with him and just being like, I feel like shit when we have these debates, like I can't handle it. And then he explained like his thought process to me, which was like, I'm not trying to win the debate. I'm trying to, I want us together to find out what the right answer is together. He's like, I don't think you're wrong and I don't think I'm right. He was like, I'm trying to work with you for us to like find a joint conclusion. And I was like, oh, you're not arguing with me. He's like, no. And so like, I was like, oh, okay. And then just like framed the entire thing so differently to me now. Actually that was really helpful. It was actually really helpful that we went through that in terms of like hypothetical debates before it then came to like stuff that was actually to do with us and our relationship. And then being like, okay, actually what we're trying to do here is we're trying to like figure this out together rather than, I think it does allow for you to be like, oh yeah, you're right, I'm wrong. Okay, yeah, you've got a good piece of an idea here. Let's take that. I think that this idea that I've had is actually really worth examining.
I think there's also something really interesting about like so a lot of what you're saying, like I recognize in like previous like relationships that I've had and like various relationships I've had, and I think there's also like a slightly interesting gendered thing as well. I think like I think when you're younger, I think girls tend to be rewarded for like empathy and emotion, and that can be, I find it really hard not to respond in a really like emotional and like way where like being kind is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Whereas I've been in relationships with people who have been certainly socialized in a very like male way, what has been really valued is kind of like intellectual argument and like being right. And I think those two things just really badly combine. And there is, I really recognize that thing of like, oh, I'm not actually debating. I'm not actually attacking you. I'm attacking an idea. And it's like, yeah, but sometimes that idea is part of who I am.
Yeah.
And also just like invalidating an emotional response can be difficult. So I think it sounds like you've come to a really healthy place where you can recognize that kind of what's a kind of hypothetical debate and what is actually I don't know, like meaningful personal content. Yeah.
It is interesting because I think one of the things that has been quite successful for us is really learning the other person's communication style. Because now, like, I know that he responds better to like more like rational arguments or what he would call a rational argument. And so like if I want to bring something to him, I'm like, here's my PowerPoint presentation as to why why this should be a thing, or like why I'm right, or whatever it is. Not like I'm right, but here is what I'm proposing. And like it, by kind of like tuning into how he best responds, it's like normally I get the answer, the response I want, because he's just like, oh yes, yeah, no, I, that makes, he's like, that makes perfect sense, yes, I'm sorry, or okay, yes, we can do this. And I'm like, yep, great, thank you.
Yeah, yeah,
hacking it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think, yeah, and I guess that's part of it, like trying to, like, that's part of going back to this, like being on the same team. Like if he tries to win the point and you try to like just like vibe and feel the things, and you're both doing different things, then that doesn't help. That doesn't help either of you. So like trying to be like, so we have these different approaches, and where can we kind of, what are we trying to work on? And yeah, I think that sounds really, that sounds really healthy and productive.
Got to get approval. Moving slightly on, but also kind of like bringing it back to like pregnancy stuff as well. So like one of the things that is in your Twitter handle is Green Campaigner. And I wanted to talk about like environmentalism along with sexual justice and sexual rights, and also like reproductive rights. Because I think at least in the West, there's a lot of conversation around like the climate crisis and having kids. And that's something that either a lot of people think about, or like it's definitely something that I got asked a lot about when I was very public about trying to get pregnant.
That's really interesting. Do you mind me asking what the sort of like frame of that was when you asked?
It was kind of like, do you think about the climate crisis in your decision to like have children in the way that we were trying to have children, which is like to have PIV sex and have a biological child, basically.
Absolutely. So kind of like what sort of almost like a slightly implied like, why don't you just adopt, that's greener kind of thing.
A little bit.
Like it's very implied, but
it's really interesting because I definitely felt a little bit defensive at first of like, we you know, like that's something that we thought about and da 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 da, and I felt like I had to kind of like justify my decision. And then there were a few other people who then responded to that being like, you don't have to justify anything.
Which to be fair is like my gut reaction is like, so I think there is a really interesting thing that runs, and I think it runs across kind of like different areas of kind of like social justice and kind of environmental activism, is this idea that is like this focus we put on like individuals. And actually like it's really human to want a family, right? It's really human to want kids, to, and if that means, if you having a baby or you having a family means that like that there's a like impact, like negative environmental impact, then that means the way we're kind of doing people and society isn't working. That doesn't mean that you're like wanting to have a baby is like is causing climate change. It's to do with how we as a society how we're doing our lives in general, and the change needs to come from like a wider like systemic change, right? So that being a person doesn't cause all these things. Not that you like Hannah, it's like, it's not that you, Hannah Witten, having a baby is causing climate change. I think that kind of runs across a lot of like social justice things, and I think often And I think it's a really important thing to kind of talk about, because often I think those arguments about like, oh, you shouldn't have a baby because that's going to consume more resources, that's kind of taking problems which are caused by, you know, big systems, by governments, by private industry, that's taking those problems and making it feel like it's an individual's responsibility. And that also that person making different decisions will fix that problem, when actually it's the responsibility of governments and big kind of multinational companies to change their behavior, because they're the ones that are causing that. So I think it's, yeah. So I think it's a really interesting conversation. And I think it's a way that sort of, sometimes us wanting to kind of enact our sort of our sexual rights or our social rights, or our just like wants to enact our kind of very like normal, fine individual rights, gets framed as a, oh, this is problematic, when actually it's not. Yeah. Governments do that in a way that sort of means that they completely like try and, it's like, look over here at this individual decision, that's the problem. So it's like the problem is that we're not recycling, like these individuals are not recycling, rather than that we have this hugely wasteful system that consumes lots and is kind of predicated on the idea that we consume lots. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. That was a bit of a sideways.
It makes a lot of sense. I remember one comment that I saw as well was saying something like, when we say that we're like, you know, trying to fight climate change and the climate crisis for the next generation, it's like, well, then who is this next generation that we're supposedly trying to save the planet for as well?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. I've seen like not a lot, but I've seen some as well, like people that kind of take those like correct, what are seen as correct choices, like so there's a big thing about like, oh, you should only have one baby because that will be like half as impactful as having two babies, which is again like a slightly bizarre logic to me. And I think it's about like, no, we need to change society so that you can have two babies and that doesn't wreck the planet.
And I think, yeah, it just makes me think about just like reproductive justice in general, I think, as well, and kind of like the history of it there too, of just like, I don't know, like there's been times in history where, depending on who you are, either you're like encouraged to have lots of children or you're very much like not encouraged to have lots of children. And I think you can very easily slip into like racism and classism and all sorts when it comes to talking
definitely.
About like, reproduction like that.
Yeah, like when I think when you, so I would always come at things from like a kind of like reproductive rights. So you have rights over your body, and that includes the right to have, to not have, to not reproduce, to have like education and access to health services and contraception and whatever you need to do that. But also that the kind of it's equally important that you have, like, you are enabled to, you have the education, the resources, whatever you need to have a family as well. And that's they're parts of this, those things aren't in conflict, they are parts of the same rights.
Yeah, I guess also I'm interested to know how all of this works out, like on an interpersonal level, especially in like the RSC context again, around like reproductive rights, especially when it comes to like when it's in a relationship. So like it's between just like two people, and that like, do you see amongst young people like pressure in relationships to kind of like use a certain kind of contraception or not use it, or like how are those conversations playing out with young people?
Yes, that's a really interesting thing. I guess I feel like the situation is, or certainly from my experience, the situation's a little bit constrained by the sort of the types of services and stuff we have available to us. Mm-hmm. So almost all a majority of contraception is for people with wombs.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem like it's going to change anytime soon. There's sometimes every now and then, every few years, there's a kind of like something crops up with a new contraception other than external condoms and vasectomy for people with penises, but that mm-hmm. never seems to actually come to fruition. Like, I know,
yeah,
we do talk
and
about
condoms and like yeah. vasectomy are two like extreme sides of like
yeah, yeah
contraceptive yeah. Options for people with wombs.
Yeah, yeah. So there is, yeah. So there is often. So I feel like the burden of contraception often falls on women, like the kind of contraceptive administration.
Oh my God, contraceptive administration, that is 100% what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, one of my colleagues kind of frames it as that, and I think that's a really great, like, word.
Yeah.
And we try and promote the idea that actually contraception is everyone involves kind of business. Yeah, I'm not sure how successful we are at that, but definitely I think like a good first step is just telling everyone about all the contraception that's available, regardless of like what kind of sex they're having or what sort of bodies they have. Like just having that as an absolute like baseline, that just everyone, like even if you don't have a uterus, you have seen a Marina coil and you know what it looks like and
yeah.
you know, you have some idea about how it works. I think that's
yeah
like
I remember like
step.
Not really, I don't think I saw one yeah until I was an adult. Like I don't think we were shown them in schools, even though it was talked about. I had the Marina coil for a while, and when I got it taken out, I asked the person who did it, being like, can I keep it? And they put it in a little thing for me, and so
oh,
I have
nice.
My coil at home.
Oh, lovely.
it's quite nice as well as a sex yeah. educator as well. I think I'm like, this is what a Marina yeah. coil looks like as well, like this is the size. Yeah.
Yeah, we have happy. Some of the like the sort of like dummy ones. We have like a little like sex ed pack, and it's got like the implant as well is another one that's really nice to show people. Although that's the implant's really an interesting one to talk about. So with kind of teenagers, so the implant so it's kind of like match, if people haven't come across it before, it's like sort of match the length and sort of size of a match, and it's kind of made of sort of mm-hmm. slightly squishy flexible material, and it's just implanted under the skin and it sort of stays there for up to a few years, and a lot of teenagers have come across it. A lot of sort of like older siblings will have one, or they'll kind of there is like often that's the only kind of device they kind of know about. Like when you're showing them the kind of the hormonal coil, they'll just be like, what on earth is that? But there is often good knowledge about an implant and what it is and where it goes,
yeah.
if not quite
maybe
how it works.
Maybe it feels like a more accessible middle ground for people in terms of like you've got the pill, which you have to take daily, and then like a coil, which gets inserted into your
yeah,
uterus
yeah.
Which I think there's also like potentially like fear around the pain of that insertion as well and then I guess also like the time as well that it lasts. People are like, okay, 3 years, you know, like
yeah
well
yeah,
then we'll see, whereas like something like 10 years is like
yeah.
What does my life even look like in 10 years? I don't know.
I think there's definitely something about like being able to touch people's implants as well. There's something about like you might have had
there it is there's my yeah. contraception, like it's
yeah.
still there,
because
yeah.
often students will know where it is kind of goes, and they'll have like touched like a sibling's, or like, you know, there's something really
yeah.
because
it's more exposure to it,
yeah, because I completely see what you mean about the like it's kind of an intermediate thing, but like something that there's, I think, generally quite poor knowledge about in this country is like the hormonal vaginal ring, which apparently...
I have one friend who has used that, and like that was her contraceptive of choice. But I don't, in my personal life, I don't know anyone else who's.
Yeah, is that in the UK or is that somewhere?
Yeah, someone in the UK.
Yeah, because when I went, so this is quite a few years ago. This is when I was medical school. So things might have changed, although my sense is not. We got taught about like different contraception by a sexual health nurse, and they were saying that the vaginal ring is like I think it's probably still true, but at the time it was like the number one hormonal contraception in Spain.
Wow.
But in the UK, it's actually quite hard to get hold of in the UK. I've recommended, because I think it's really good. So again, it's this kind of like, so it's hormonal, it's super, super effective because it's a device that you put into your body. It's not like the pill, like if you vomit a lot or you forget that it just won't work. It's less reliant on kind of memory. But it's something you can insert yourself. So you put it into, so it looks like a kind of a sort of a rubber ring. And you put it into the vagina like you would a pessary, and you can just do that at home, and it stays in for several weeks, and then you take it out and then reinsert it after a week. So it's like something you have like quite a lot of control over. So I think like the methodology, like the method is like really, really sound. So I've actually recommended it to a few friends who've like asked, yeah, because I've become that friend.
Love being that friend.
And like a couple of them like, oh yeah, this sounds really good. And a couple of them have tried and just not been, like GPs have just been really unwilling to do that because it's not something they're kind of familiar with, and they sort of, I think, perhaps unwittingly kind of push their own agenda. So yeah, that's an interesting one. But apparently, yeah, Spanish healthcare services, it's much more popular.
That's so interesting. I love hearing like little facts about like cultural differences in all of these things as well, because I'm like, why is it? Is it like promoted more there, or like is there something about Spanish people that they're just like, yeah, the vaginal ring, bring it on? Like,
yeah,
it's so interesting to me. I love it. We had some questions from folks on Instagram that I wanted to pose to you. This one kind of relates to, so I've first came across you when I saw you speak on the panel at the School of Sex Ed's book launch. Uh-huh. And I remember one of the things that you talked about on that panel was about like how biological sex is like so much more complicated than what we got taught in school. And it's not as clear cut as like male, female, and all of that. And somebody also asked, and I they're referring to like obs and gynae here, how do you make a very woman-focused specialty more inclusive for trans people?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good question. It's a really good question. I am not sure I have a brilliant, comprehensive answer. Other than that, that's something that we need to do. I guess. Mm-hmm. I wonder if, and if anyone does have any answers, then please do get in touch.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's something around giving voice to people's experiences. So one of the most sort of biggest like resistances I find to sort of change within services is like, oh, well, we don't really need to do this because it's not really needed, and there's so few people that it kind of relates to, and blah, blah, blah. And I think that's wrong, because even if it's only a small number of people, that small number of people still, they still have rights. But also like sometimes the experiences are much less rare than we kind of assume. So not fitting into a kind of very sort of typical gendered cishet paradigm. Like if you're talking about like someone who's a trans man, that might not be super, who is pregnant, that might not be super common. But actually just not like that very specific instance, but just like some way not kind of fitting into a cishet paradigm and having, and going through pregnancy and fertility experiences, that's actually pretty common. Like it's pretty common to have some sort of, like for you or your relationship or something to not kind of fit into that paradigm. Yeah, that is actually super common. So I think maybe giving voice to people, giving platform and space and time, and if you're working within the service, like an audience to people that are being open to hearing people's experiences where they don't have kind of typical experiences. I'm thinking really specifically of Freddie McConnell. Have you come across him before?
I recognize the name. Is he a trans man who was pregnant? I think I've seen him
speak. Journalist. I think he sort of self-styles himself as like seahorse dad. So he's had now two pregnancies he's a trans man. He's also like very, very like very mask looking. I think even when he was quite pregnant, like even when he was like in his third term, you would look at him and think that's a woman with a moustache. You would think that's a very kind of typical cis man. And he's done quite a lot of work about his experiences. He's made a documentary about it. And I guess like just kind of listening to that and. Mm-hmm. I remember just listening to some of his stuff and this was after I'd kind of stopped working in ONG and just thinking about some of the stuff that we did and some of the things that happened, and I'm just like how would that work the way that we kind of start, how would that work for this person? Just kind of listening to people's experiences if you're working in services, giving your time to that or not, or thinking about how else you might platform those experiences.
I really love your point about how like just either not conforming to like our assumptions about people's gender or gender expression or sexuality or like relationship status, like there's so that it's so much more common than we think that people don't fit into these like really neat boxes. Our midwife at one of our recent appointments asked me and my partner if we were married, and we were like yeah, and she was just like, oh, very rare these days. And I was just like, yeah, because we kind of very much do fit that mold of maybe like what people are trained to kind of like expect to come into the clinic and stuff. But I just thought it was really nice that she acknowledged that that's not really the case as much anymore.
And I think there are so many, like I have a friend who who her and her partner had a baby together. they're married. They're two married women. And my understanding is the way they treated her wife, they'd make a lot of assumptions even within that. So they recognize that they were like a couple. Mm-hmm. So they didn't necessarily know that. So my friend's wife, the non-pregnant person, is a trans woman. So they try and like make, but they made a lot of assumptions when they saw two women presenting about like they must have had fertility treatment, blah, blah, blah. And they try and like make common ground with them, like based on that, to be like, oh, so who's your fertility specialist? And they'd be like, okay, no, this is like a bio baby. We had PIV sex. And just like, and I think that sort of played into, I don't know, I'm maybe speaking a bit beyond like my experience, but I wonder if that played into like my friend's like gender dysphoria, because I don't know, just kind of not accepting some of the experiences they've had, or just assuming that they didn't exist.
You just don't know unless you ask how people got pregnant or like what their gender, sexuality, relationship structure, family structure is, and all of that.
I guess as well with like with healthcare professionals, like in terms of like how we can change services, like it's okay to ask. Like you would mm-hmm. ask, there's all sorts of stuff that we just wouldn't assume about people. Like in a lot of medicine, we would never assume like that people did or didn't have certain health conditions. We'd ask them, but like mm-hmm. we'll often completely assume what kind of like reproductive organs people have.
Yeah, which is a huge part
their,
of health.
Their name. Yeah, based on their name.
yeah.
And there are some really inelegant, yeah, there are some really inelegant, I've seen some really inelegant like ways when people don't fit into that like paradigm. So like when we, when I've looked after like, or when I've had like handover for patients that are transgender, there'll be like this huge like, oh my god, like you'll see like referral letters like basically the point is this person, you know, had a fall, broke their arm, maybe has broken their arm, and we need that to be investigated.
Mm-hmm.
But there'll just be this long like history of like every gender clinic appointment they've ever had in the like the letter to A&E, and you're just like, wow. This is where they've like mixed up the pronouns and just like what the information you want to know is what happened to this person and what might they have hurt, and like none of this is relevant, and if you feel it is, you can ask.
Slightly different, but still on kind of like the pregnancy topic. Somebody asked, as a doctor, how do you strike the balance of birth/pregnancy being a natural process and a medical event? This intrigued me.
So how do you strike the balance between birth being a natural, like a natural thing, a thing our bodies do, and it being something? Yeah, that's again a really good question, and I'm not sure that I do that well. I'm not sure I kind of I guess being like very comfortable about what the limits of your knowledge are. So like I've never given birth. I don't know what that's like. And even if I had, like I still wouldn't really know what that's like for everyone, just for me. So I think just being honest that I understand there are sometimes like problematic kind of medical, like that pregnancy is seen as kind of like a disease, like it's kind of treated, so you go to hospital, you blah, 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 all these things. It's kind of like treated like a disease when actually it's like a normal body process. Like kind of just acknowledging that that exists, and also that like people are very different, and that's fine, and that no two people's experiences are going to be the same, and nobody will kind of know what pregnancy is like for anybody, including like even if they've gone through the same experience,
mm-hmm.
It's the same type of experience. It's not the same experience because there'll be loads of different things. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's definitely been points in my pregnancy where I've been like, I was born to be pregnant. Like, this is so natural. And like, this just feels so right. And then other times where I'm like, I need medical intervention. Like, like this is a medical thing that's happening to my body right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I have really interesting conversations with people I know who've been pregnant and given birth, and it's really interesting. I find that sort of older people tend to be a bit more like open to the idea that it's different to everyone. Like I think when someone who's a similar age to me, like a few years ago, had their first baby and was just like, she just became like in her mind, I felt like she became like the authority on being pregnant and having babies. And like, when I talked to my mum was like, oh, well, like when I had you and when I had your brother later, that was completely different experiences. And like, just a bit more open to that. But my friend after her one baby was like, oh yeah, I know I am the mother now.
This is the experience of pregnancy.
Yeah. Then when other friends got pregnant, she'd be like, oh, well, you'll need this and this, and this is what happens, and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you're definitely the expert on your pregnancy that you just had. But I'm not sure. And it was really interesting because I'd had, like, obviously I'd not had like an experience, like a personal experience, but I'd seen a lot more pregnancies than her, and I'd met a lot more pregnant people than she had at this point, and like helped deliver a lot more. Yeah.
It's definitely interesting because I'm in a position where like I really haven't encountered that many pregnant people, at least pregnant folks who I'm close enough to like actually ask some of the more like intimate questions to and have those kinds of conversations with. So I definitely felt like I was like, you know, I have some ideas about what pregnancy entails, but it's very much just been a like, we learn as we go.
Yeah. There is something about like collective knowledge that I think is different from like my parents' generation, that like we tend not to, I think it goes back to this kind of like idea that we don't teach young people that like pregnancy is something that relates to them. It's something that they mustn't do. And we kind of, I think it kind of goes back to that we just like I don't remember really like seeing a pregnant person when I was a child really, or like knowing anyone who was having a baby or very much at all. Whereas I think my mom's experience, my dad's experience is certainly a different, like he had sort of older siblings and he was in a sort of a, like more of a kind of community where you sort of did know that a bit more.
Yeah. The collective knowledge is definitely something that I've come across like since being pregnant. And that is definitely, I find very useful. And a friend of mine actually, who has just recently gotten pregnant, was messaging me being like, can I ask you about discharge in pregnancy? Like there's just so much, like what happened to you? And I was like, oh my God, yeah, there was so much like dripping. And it's just really interesting of just like, wait, is this normal? And kind of like, but then also like having to caveat that like it happened to me and it was fine for me, but you never know, like obviously like you know your body better, so like
that's something, you know, interesting. Actually, that is something that I bring up in, so we talk about like anatomy and vulval and vaginal anatomy, and like we talk about discharge, and I talk about it being different, and like pregnancy is one of the examples that I give, that like you might have a lot of quite white discharge in pregnancy, and it's just all about what you're, that is a like really specific example I give because I've had that experience, like not personally but of kind of looking after people that are just like, what is happening?
Yeah, just like, why am I, my underwear just like soaked all the time? Well, Emma, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this this conversation. Where can people like find you online if they want to check out more
so,
of you?
So I write a blog, squishsquashsquelch.com, which has been a bit poorly maintained recently. I kind of stick on ideas about kind of sometimes things that have kind of come up in sort of sessions, and I don't really have time to answer, or sort of things that are slightly supplemental to some of the stuff I do in school. But
amazing. Well, thank you so much, and thank you all for listening. Bye.